Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, we've got lots to be proud of in our state, and nobody sings our praises better from the western mountaintops to the coastline than the national award-winning Our State magazine. Spend a few minutes with Editor-in-Chief Elizabeth Hudson, as we will today, and you'll soon find out why. It's January in the Triad, and that can only mean one thing for Piedmont parents: summer camp enrollment. And Children's Theater of Winston-Salem's Karen McHugh and Bobby Bodford have an idea or two just for you. WFDD's Bethany Chafin is here for a literary talk with Triad author Nilla Childs. Nilla shares what it's like loving someone with Asperger's syndrome in her fascinating new book, Puzzled: 100 Pieces of Autism. And UNCSA professor Sheila Brown is here. She'll put the lie once and for all to the disparaging myths and cruel jokes about her instrument, the viola. She's got lots to say and plenty to play live in Studio A next on Triad Arts Weekend. You've seen it at bookstores, newsstands, and lobbies everywhere. On the outside cover, there's an artful photograph and some tantalizing article headings. But open it up, like the more than 800,000 people who do it each year in every state in the Union and 42 countries worldwide, and you'll find an incredible magazine that just happens to be entirely devoted to North Carolina, people, places, history, and travel. It's Our State magazine, celebrating 80 years of awe-inspiring photographs and fantastic stories that'll have visitors and North Carolina natives alike scratching their heads and saying, "Gosh, I didn't know that was here." Our State's January issue is no exception, with The Secret to Good Snow Cream, Why Everyone's Listening to the Avett Brothers, How North Carolina Helped Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin Go to the Moon, and much more. The monthly's success hasn't gone unnoticed by the magazine industry's leading trade publication, Folio. Last year, Folio awarded Our State an Eddie Gold Award for the best full issue in the regional consumer magazine category. Editor-in-Chief Elizabeth Hudson certainly has her finger on the pulse of Our State. She stopped by to share her enthusiasm for what she does and what she's learned about her home state along the way.
Over the years, you know, some of the biggest lessons I think that I've learned are how to think about the magazine as a coherent whole. You know, when you work on particular stories, you think about the story as a self-contained piece or a self-contained unit. And as editor-in-chief, one of the things that I have to keep in mind every month, really with every issue, is how everything fits together. You know, like one big puzzle piece. You know, you want to feel that the magazine has a singular voice and a singular sound, and that I don't want a reader to read something and think, well, that doesn't belong in there at all. You know, you really do need to think about how everything fits together and flows. I like for the stories to flow sort of one into the other so that there's nothing that is jarring or a story that feels like maybe it doesn't belong in there. I'd say that's one of the biggest things. You learn how to work with writers, certainly. You learn how to, I don't know, I mean, you kind of hear the sound of North Carolina through the stories that we run. Of course, there are a lot of stories that we get in that can sound real similar. You know, sometimes a writer, we do a department in the magazine called Tar Heel Towns, a beloved department. It's been running for, oh gosh, as long as I've been there, and it was even before that. It's probably been running 25 years maybe. And we'll go into towns to figure out, you know, the essence of the town. What makes this place this place? And when you work with freelance writers, a lot of times the freelance writers will go into these towns and they'll kind of come back with similar conclusions. You know, a lot of small towns in North Carolina are really looking toward the future while embracing their past, which is wonderful. You know, we all want that. The challenge when you edit a magazine is how do you keep those stories from sounding similar from month to month to month, you know? So I'd say that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned is how to do that.
Yeah. I think personally, what I've always been struck just glancing through the magazine is that the subjects you do pick seem to just always resonate with me. I mean, just my personal take, that issue, that the award-winning issue, the July 2011 issue, no exception. Just it was the East-West issue, which is, and my mom lives in Asheville. Mm-hmm. We've got friends in Wilmington. there is a very, very different world in both places. Yep. Photo essay devoted to North Carolina peaches, which is always delicious and interesting. And then the third installment of your popular Civil War series. Putting that all together, Elizabeth, could you put me in the editor's chair there?
Sure.
What was left on the drawing room floor? I want to be a fly on the wall, that initial planning session.
Well, the initial planning session actually took place in a van. There were about seven of us in the editorial department who physically produced the copy and the content of the magazine each month, which for for a 200-page plus magazine is a very small staff. We had an editorial retreat. It was me and the art director and the editors, and off we went to the mountains for just sort of a 2-day planning session. And we were on our way back, you know, all of us piled in this van, and we kind of got in this conversation about how about half of us are mountain people and half of us are beach people. And, you know, you really kind of are one of the other. I know we like to say in North Carolina, oh, we love both. And certainly that's true. But most people will have a little bit of a sense toward one or the other. And we kind of got into this spirited debate, which we're, you know, as editors and art directors are prone to do. Creative people can do that kind of thing. And we get in a little bit of an argument, you know, oh, the mountains are great because, or the beach is better because. And I said, you know, wouldn't it be fun if we did an issue that really explored that concept, kind of this idea of here's the East, here's the West, what are the differences and what are the similarities? Ultimately, what we found in doing that issue, we set out to really explore the differences, and we kind of came to the conclusion with each story that it really is the similarities that draw you. You know, far Eastern and far Western, you're talking about remote places, and there's still that connecting thread of community no matter what. When you're way far away, you're looking for community to bind you together. You're looking for the same thing in the East. Accents change a little bit. Dialect changes a little bit. Food changes. You know, barbecue, East-West barbecue is different. But ultimately, it comes down to the passion and the people that are cooking it, how they feel about what they're making. You know, the differences are in the small details. The similarities are in the overarching concepts, and those become really what matters. That becomes the soul. The soul is the same.
The sweetest surrender of winter, she put up a flag, it is waving.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I'm talking today with Our State Magazine's editor-in-chief, Elizabeth Hudson. So tell me about the January issue.
Oh,
what's the focus?
The January issue was a great issue for us because it kicks off the 80th anniversary of Our State Magazine. We started in 1933, and it's always fun to do the first issue of the year. This one has on the cover a big bowl of snow cream, which is something that every Southerner who grew up here will remember making with just the least little hint of snow. You scrape a little bit. It's got to be the second snow, by the way. You can't do it from the first snow.
Oh, how about that?
The
snow tastes better.
The snow is cleaner on the second go-around, so they say. So you always have to wait for that second snow before you can scrape up for snow cream. The idea behind the January issue, we really wanted to create these stories that talked about these small things that started in North Carolina that have gotten big, things that really have just burst out of our own geographical boundaries and in some cases go international. We have pieces on the Avett Brothers, which is an extraordinary band from Concord, North Carolina. I believe they have the number 3 folk record is the category in the world. They just are an amazing band.
Who saw you this anger?
We have stories on Vala Simpson, an internationally recognized folk artist who makes these gigantic windmill structures that tower 50 feet in the air in Wilson, North Carolina. We have a story on Jockey's Ridge, the tallest sand dune on the East Coast, which is on the Outer Banks. You know, again, you think about something that just sort of started with a little tiny grain of sand and has grown and grown and grown into something that is massive, and nobody else has this. We have that right here. And we have a great piece on a company right outside of Statesville that manufactures rocking chairs. They've been making them since 1924. Anybody who comes into North Carolina through the Charlotte Douglas International Airport will see a line of these rocking chairs that are all over the airport. What a perfect introduction to this state. Southern hospitality at its finest. Come on in, have a seat in one of our rocking chairs that are handmade and handcrafted right here in this state. A lot of people would never even know that these rocking chairs are made right here.
They are so perfect at the airport.
Yeah, we've got stories about Morehead Planetarium in Chapel Hill and how Morehead was a training ground for nearly every astronaut all the way through the 70s. Neil, Buzz, you know, they all trained right here in North Carolina. Again, things people might not automatically know. Lots of good things in January.
Lots of stuff. I mean, and the Now we're celebrating 80 years, going back to the early mid-30s. What sorts of stories were grabbing them back then? Have you looked through the archives?
We do look through the archives. The early editions of our state are drastically different from what you see now. The magazine was a weekly then. It was actually called The State. It wasn't called Our State. The name change happened in 1996 when our current publisher bought it. The Hour, just being a little bit more inclusive, less distant than The State. But the early issues were still a celebration of North Carolina. You know, it was a lot of land stories, land use, an unbelievable amount of tobacco advertising.
Well, how about New Year's coming up? Any traditions here in the state that I need to know about?
Well, one of the great things about our state is it is a good introduction to the South and to North Carolina. You could really think of it as your tutorial to being a Tar Heel. You know, what do you need to know? January, certainly the New Year's table is something we all think about, and what you're going to eat for your New Year's Day meal to ensure that you have lots of luck, success, happiness, money, you know, good fortune. But you didn't know there are certain things you can eat that, you know, an old Southern custom is that will influence your luck in the coming year. You're going to want to eat some black-eyed peas, and you're going to want to eat ham and collard greens. And, you know, the idea that anything green on your plate, collard greens, turnip greens, is an indicator of good health. And the black-eyed peas stand for coins that you're going to receive some money in the new year. Just a little bit of a good luck meal that we like to celebrate on New Year's Day. We're going to tell you how to make sure you do that in our state in January.
Seasons turn in time. There's a change.
Our State Magazine, Editor-in-Chief Elizabeth Hudson. You'll find the January issue at newsstands and bookstores. Find out what the Avett brothers were up to before the late-night talk shows, major labels, sharing the stage at the Grammys with Bob Dylan, and what life was like for them growing up in Cabarrus County, and why everyone's listening to them now. Also, whirligigs, snow cream, and how North Carolina helped Neil and Buzz go to the moon. You'll find plenty of awe-inspiring photography to go along with our state's lively stories as well, and there's a link to our state on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Yep, we're pretty lucky to live in our state. And right here in the Triad, we're very fortunate to have such a dynamic arts scene. For decades, one of the pillars of this thriving community has been theater, and that extends to children's theater as well. If you're a parent or grandparent looking for good quality, wholesome entertainment options for children, the Children's Theater of Winston-Salem is a great place to start. This weekend, they'll be presenting the incredible New York-based company Theater Works USA performing Bunnicula. Saturday morning, January 12th at 11 o'clock at the Arts Council Theater, 610 Coliseum Drive. Bunnicula is recommended for grades 2 through 6, and coming up in February, it'll be the little engine that could earns her whistle for grades pre-K through 3rd. Here to talk with me about vampire bunnies and to share the secret to their wildly successful theater summer camps for kids are Children's Theater of Winston-Salem General Manager Karen McHugh and Artistic Education Director Bobby Botford.
Bunnicula is a unique vampire, not just because he's a bunny. He just sucks the color out of the vegetables.
Yeah, he sucks the juice out of them.
I love that.
Well, when my kids were small, we read the series. It's a series of books, Bunnicula, and this story is based on the series of children's books. But what I used to love most about Bunnicula were the titles of the books. For example, A Rabbit Tale of Mystery, The Howliday Inn, and my favorite, The Celery Stalks at Midnight.
That's great.
So we read them like crazy. And when I saw that Bunnicula was actually being performed as a show, I jumped on it because it was some of our favorite books when my kids were small. So
tell me a little bit about Theater Works. It's not Salma. You guys have worked in them before?
Yes. Theater Works, they're from New York City. They're extremely talented young adult performers. And they primarily perform for children, and they tour. They've been here every year, and this year, they did Skippy John Jones for us. They're doing Bunnicula, and also they're doing our last show, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, and other storybooks. And actually, I think that's their strongest kind of show. They do these reviews where they take a variety of kids' stories, and they create one show. It's like parts of each story in the show. Those are very popular. I love bringing them here.
They are an incredibly high-quality professional touring company. I've been watching theater a long time. They're as good as any group I've ever seen touring. Yeah. And they're consistent. Everything is good. Everything.
And the cool thing about Bunnicula, too, is that the story is told from the dog's perspective. His name is Harold. And the story is that the family finds a bunny at the theater after watching a Dracula film, hence the name Benicula. And they also have a cat named Chester who is convinced that Benicula is a vampire because they find these vegetables drained of their juice.
So, Karen, what's the latest with the summer camps for Winston-Salem Children's Center?
I just know that last year we actually had to add a week because people were clamoring to get their kids into our camp. So what Bobby came up with was, let's do a week-long camp for the younger kids. We did 101 Dalmatians kids, and it's specifically designed to be a camp for a week.
We almost had 101.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We had
it was close.
Like 80 kids or something.
I think it was more than that. It was like 85.
Well, you know, we have the campers and then we have the counselors.
Yes,
and we
I will say our ratio with counselors and interns for those small camps is like 8 to 1.
Wow.
So it's they're very well taken care of.
And who are these instructors? Where are you? Are you calling from universities in the area, professionals from outside?
All of the above. We are lucky enough to have some of the kids that, well, they're not kids anymore. They're young adults now that grew up in this program and were in it since they were little. Now off to college. They're all very smart, but they came back last summer and really helped me put it all together. That's a great thing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, then they'll all go off back to college. And so we'll have to train some more.
That is, you know, it translates as a camper from the camps that I went to as a young person. When my peers who have then graduated and come back, it gives you a sense of tradition that you can't quite put your finger on it, but it just feels comfy.
It does. Well, it makes you want to do that. I mean, I've had campers that then got to be interns last year. So they get to share the things that they've learned, and then they're hoping that they'll be interns for a couple of years and then become a counselor, and then maybe they'll become the head counselor. But it's like Karen says, growing. We did 15 camps last year.
Wow.
From one or two the years before. But I'm excited about what we're doing this year.
Because in addition to having great facilities and great staff on hand and your wealth of knowledge and background on this, you pick great plays and great musicals and beginning with Get Smart.
Get Smart. For the middle schoolers, they're great. They did Connecticut Yankee last year. They are amazing to work with as young actors. They are ready to go to create and perform. And you can just get them to do anything. They will so commit to the project. I love that about the middle schoolers.
It's an impressionable age, lots going on internally, and I imagine that could translate into great performances.
It gives them, they can use those inner resources to create these characters.
Yeah.
And we do a non-musical for them, but then their age is also covered in the main musical, which this year is going to be
one of the greatest stories ever. Dolls, Willy Wonka.
Yeah, that's our big musical. That's the 3-week musical camp. That's the longest camp we have. That's the biggest production that we do. And it also covers the most age range. So it's from like 10 to 18 years old.
That's quite a spectrum.
It is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the 10-year-olds don't have a chance at playing leading characters. I mean, not every 10-year-old is going to be an Oompa Loompa. You know? But we will have lots of Oompa Loompas, I hope.
Hey, admit, if I was going to be in that play, that's what I'd want to be.
Oompa
Loompa, doopity-doo. I've got another puzzle for you.
All right, I think we should accept him into camp, don't you think?
Go on and on.
Paint me green and let me leave.
Oompa Loompa, doopity-dee. If you are wise, you'll listen to me.
What do you get when you guzzle down sweets?
Eating as much as an elephant eats.
What are you at getting terribly fat? What do you think will come of that?
I don't like the look of it. Oompa Loompa doopity-da.
Last year, Little Mermaid was visually just beautiful because we've got Scott Needham, an in-house lighting designer now that's from New York who knows what he's doing. He does a beautiful job. We have our master artist, world-class painter doing our sets, which is incredible, with Chip Holton. And after seeing Little Mermaid, I know that we can make this one of the most magical-looking things you've seen on the stage. I don't care, children's theater, adult theater, whatever.
Great. It seems like you'd need to have people of that caliber to pull it off, because I'm just thinking Willy Wonka, okay, the factory, the tubes getting sucked up in the chocolate river. I mean, lots of stuff going on. How
That's
do you pull
right.
it off?
It's going to be like magic. You know, the great thing about theater is it is an illusion. And sometimes the simplest tricks, like a ghost standing on a staircase and then walking off of it and going from tall to short, it's the simple stuff that makes it work. But you got to have the artist to pull it off. And we have this incredible group of people that love children, and we all like working together. And it's really not a children's theater production to us at all. It's Broadway Junior.
And I also need to mention, too, that when a child is in our camp, they're just not acting on stage. They get to participate in helping to build the sets. Right. And they help to paint the sets. And they learn about what it is backstage. And they learn about the booths. And so they get a very well-rounded experience in theater. And then they get to be on the stage as well. So
we spend 7 hours a day together.
It's a three-week camp. So there's a lot of time that we have them. And there's a lot for us to teach them. So it's a really wonderful, full theater experience.
You're going to love this. Just love it.
I'm David Ford, and you're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I've been chatting with Children's Theater of Winston-Salem General Manager Karen McHugh and Artistic Education Director Bobby Bodford. After this short break, we'll take a sneak peek at more of their theater summer camp productions, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Cinderella, and The Bard, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
The rowers keep on rowing, and they're certainly not showing any signs that they are slowing!
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I'm talking with Children's Theater of Winston-Salem Artistic Education Director Bobby Bodford. General Manager Karen McHugh joined us as well. It's January 2013, just in time to ensure a place for your kids and grandkids in summer camp. Karen and Bobby have just the thing.
Salagadoola, Mitchagaboola, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
The Disney Kids production was so successful last year, we have to bring it back. So this year it's going to be Cinderella Kids.
Perfect.
So, you know, in honor of them bringing it back to Broadway.
Well, and I know regardless of whether it's the kids version or the junior version, you're going to get a real Broadway-like experience working with Bobby Bodford.
They get a real solid theatrical experience. Like you mentioned, the resources are there. It's incredible. Little guys on a big stage. It's a great fit. It really is. And I will say this is the Disney Cinderella, so this is Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo and all of those songs that they are already familiar with.
Disney Cinderella Kids, and that's, as you mentioned, from ages 5 to 12. Then we get to a little horror later on in the season. This is a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde production for the older kids.
That's for the teenagers.
Yeah.
It's a melodrama. Okay, it's in the same vein as when we did Dracula a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That teenagers really like an opportunity to just grab on to something and give me some drama. So a melodrama is drama a little bit over the top. I plan for it to be kind of scary, so it will be a thriller. That's the way we're billing it.
Can you generalize that way, Bobby, in your experience in terms of which sorts of plays, be it the melodrama, comedy, musical, young people excel most in? Or can you make a generalization like that?
I don't think they really care. They just want to act. I happen to believe comedy is a little more difficult than drama.
Timing?
Timing. There's some technical skills that are involved there, holding for laughs.
Yeah.
You know, there's things that you just can't let go of. Whereas in a drama, I think as long as you don't fall in the orchestra pit, you can probably really get lost in your character. And silence is good for drama. Silence is not good for comedy.
And I'm just glancing through the half-day camps as well. What an amazing series of programs here. I mean, and familiar works for many, if not all of our listeners, beginning with Beauty and the Beast. Before we get into that, though, how does a day roll out in the half-day program?
They're split into two camps, two sessions. It was so popular the first year we introduced it, we had to double it. The very first year we did it, we ended up with 72 kids. So, and they were all doing Snow White. So we decided we should get a little more variety going on there for them. So we split it into two different shows. The show is narrator driven. So the instructor will tell the story while the kids act it out. So in the half day, they do rehearse, but they also play a lot of theater games. This is just the preschool kindergarten to get them used to it, to get them to understand the disciplines that are involved and make sure they have a good time too.
Sure.
So Beauty and the Beast and The Frog Prince. The fairy tales are the easiest thing to work with kids.
Give me a taste of some of the theatrical game studies that they'll go through to kind of reinforce just good acting technique.
There's a ton of games that we play that all go to just basic skills. There's one they really love. It's called Wax Museum. Even the older kids like to play it. But it's where you freeze in a position and there's one night watchman of the museum who tries to catch you moving. So the idea is when they're not looking at you, you change your position. And whoever's last standing wins, and they get to be the night watchman.
Perfect. The theatrical version of freeze tag.
Well, there's nothing more important than being able to stand still on stage. So it's a really important skill to learn. We have this thing we call the middle school shuffle. It's very hard for young actors to stand still. They're always moving around. But if they move around, I watch their feet and not their face. And I tell them the strongest position on stage is standing still.
I've heard that. Why is that?
Well, because of the focus. I want to pay attention to what you're saying. I want to see your expression. If you're shuffling your feet all around. Now, that's not to say you don't move. Of course you move.
Sure.
But movement needs to have a purpose. Okay. Then it matters. It all goes together. Makes a nice, complete little package there. But if you're just up there shuffling around, I'm looking at your feet.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I'm talking with Children's Theater of Winston-Salem General Manager Karen McHugh and Artistic Education Director Bobby Bodford. So we can jump ahead to A Midsummer Night's Camp.
Shakespeare has been popular since we started building these camps. This year we moved it back to the 7, 8, and 9-year-olds. It is a great time to meet the bard. And Kay Smitherman, the same instructor that we've had for the last several years, is just absolutely perfect at getting these kids turned on by William Shakespeare.
So many adults think, oh, Shakespeare, it must be so hard. It's almost a foreign language. But I mean, I've heard young people say, no, actually, when it's written that way, it's easier to memorize a line somehow.
Well, because it's not the way we speak. So it's fun. It's challenging. Kids can do incredible things. One of the things you have to do in the theater is learn lines. And I go through this with these kids all the time. They will wait until the last minute to learn 4 or 5 lines. And I know that at any point in time, they can take 30 minutes and walk right on stage line perfect. We're looking to bring that out of them while they have a great time. There's nothing that says you can't have a good time and be professional, or I need to quit.
My thanks to Children's Theater of Winston-Salem Artistic Education Director Bobby Bodford and General Manager Karen McHugh. You can take in a show just for kids this Saturday morning, January 12th at 11 o'clock at the Arts Council Theater, 610 Coliseum Drive. Bunnicula, performed by the New York-based company Theater Works USA, is recommended for grades 2 through 6. You'll find ticket information, performance calendar, and Adventures in Theater Summer Camp 2013 registration forms at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Time for another short intermission. And when we return, Winston-Salem author Nilla Childs is here to share the everyday struggles and triumphs involved in loving someone with Asperger's syndrome. She talks about her new book with our associate producer, Bethany Chafin. Then we're off to Studio A with violist, that's right, violist, Sheila Brown. She's got lots to say and even more to play next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and you know, I'm thrilled to be able to cover all the arts for you each week, like dance, music, art, and theater. But due to the limitations, this darned 24 hours in a day thing, when it comes to literature, this show has always stuck to short stories, poetry, and children's books. Until now, that is. Thankfully for us, and for you, the listener, Triad Arts Associate Producer Bethany Chafin is here to expand our horizon. So, Bethany, welcome to the talking side of Triad Arts Weekend.
Thanks, David. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. And so, with so many amazing authors living here in the Triad, Winston-Salem, High Point, Greensboro area, it seems like we could probably do a whole Triad Arts book segment every day. What specific sorts of books are you going to be looking at on the show?
Well, first, you're right, David. There are so many great writers in this area. But, you know, we're going to start with doing a monthly feature on Triad Arts. And we'll be looking at all sorts of genres and talking to authors of autobiographies, fiction, even historical works. And we'll be interviewing these authors, but maybe even we'll throw in a visiting writer who might be in town for a local book reading or a big event. So I'm very excited about this.
Well, that's great. I want to mention that for Triad authors out there, you can send your book suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. And, well, we've got a good one this week with Nilla Childs, Winston-Salem author. Bethany, what struck you most reading Nilla's new book, Puzzled, 100 Pieces of Autism?
Yeah, David, that would have to be Nilla's writing style. And Nilla's, she's wonderful. But I was really struck by the choices she made in structuring her book. She discusses Asperger's syndrome, and so she's taken the concept of the puzzle, mm-hmm. which is the symbol for autism and Asperger's, and she's used it as sort of a guiding metaphor in her writing. So instead of chapters, Nilla writes in pieces. And then these pieces are organized into categories which relate to the process of putting a jigsaw puzzle together. So this book was really unique and unlike anything I've read in a while. And she's just a very creative, sincere author.
Yeah, I have to agree there. I'm looking forward to hearing this interview. So take it away, Bethany.
Thanks, David. You know, when I think about it, Nilla Childs she's a great storyteller. And it really comes out in this collection of true stories of a determined mother who never gives up on her quirky son. Nilla's a Winston-Salem-based author, and she shares the story of her family. Her oldest son was diagnosed with Asperger's when he was 23, and her book highlights the everyday struggles and triumphs associated with Asperger's syndrome. You can join Nilla for a discussion of her book at the Forsyth Public Library, Walkertown branch, at 7 p.m. on January 22nd. And in the meantime, Nilla joined me recently to talk about her book, beginning with Asperger's.
The main characteristics are impacting social skills and communication. And the third one is called executive function, which sort of means, think of an executive in an office and they're having to manage a lot of things at once. So it involves planning and delegation and managing multiple things at once. But the main impact, I would say, for Daniel is social disability.
How would you describe your communication style with Daniel and his with you?
Well, I feel a great lack there. I want to hear more from him. That's my way of feeling connected. And that's not his way of feeling connected. He likes to do activities with me. So I find that I really try to grab anything that he's interested in and go with that. But our communication is very different, where I use words and eye contact and expression and touch and hugs. And he's really just there. And he's observing a lot, but it's not apparent to observe him that that's what he's doing.
Your chapter on silence, I thought, was beautiful. Mm. You illustrate the silence because a lot of the space on the pages in this section, the space is empty.
So here I was writing all these words, and you know, none of it was really communicating the silence that I felt. And I thought, you know what it's like is a big blank page or maybe a few words on the page. Look at this blank page for the same amount of time that you would spend reading a page full of words. That is how long the silence lasts. I ask a question and the pause is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes 7 seconds long or longer. And that is only the times when he intends to answer my question. It simply takes him a while to process what I have asked him, then a while for him to process what he thinks, and then a few more seconds to form what he wants to say.
What do you think is the most useful or powerful either emotional tool or communication tool that you've learned because of Daniel?
I'm so glad you asked, because really the most astounding thing is all the beauty contained within him that other people cannot see. And I feel like I'm entitled to see this great treasure within a person that the world may not be able to see. And that's the main reason I wrote the book, is to try to let the secret out. You know, I see Daniel doesn't look like he's paying attention, but he's actually the most observant person in the room. And he doesn't do things that are just socially expected, but he does things that are even more deep and meaningful and significant. When my other son's dog died, and Daniel didn't say, "I'm sorry," or anything like that, and I wondered if he didn't care that his brother's dog had died. And a few days later, he said, "I thought about giving my dog to them." And, you know, there could not be any more. I mean, he loves his dog. It was absolutely giving the thing that he loved the most to his brother, which is so much more significant than just saying sorry.
Daniel was diagnosed when he was 23. Where did you go? You know, what sort of resources? Because the internet was pretty new. Can you talk about that?
The internet was new. And if there hadn't been the internet, I would not have gotten any resources. And it's kind of ironic to me that what kind of seems to have taken my son away from me, the computer, is also the thing that held the answers to him. And there was, you know, not only information there, but there were also links from the OASIS website. That was about the only thing I could find at the time. And links from there to a school in Florida where we could take him to get some help.
So in addition to all of the support and love that you expressed in your book that your family has given to Daniel and that Daniel has given to you all, what are some of the resources throughout his life that have been incredibly helpful to you all and to him?
One of the best things that's happened to Daniel is our next door neighbors, and they are so supportive of Daniel. They invite him over for dinner and play board games and go to movies, and that's been incredible. And that friendship probably developed out of a meeting that I had when Daniel was coming back from the program he was in Florida. And I called the meeting Circle of Friends, and I gathered people together because we were all discovering for the first time what Daniel needed. And, you know, he was 23 before he was diagnosed. So this meeting was really just to let people know Daniel's wonderful strengths and the things that he needed help with. And so their friendship grew out of that meeting of my asking for help on Daniel's behalf. And I hope that the book Puzzled is doing that in a way too, where it's educating people, not educating, because that sounds so tutorial, but the stories help people to understand, you know, the wonderful things about Daniel and the ways that people can be helpful. The other organization that's been a huge help to Daniel and to the community here and to me as a parent is the ICANN House, which is a place that offers social skills and support for people with social differences.
The feedback that Daniel gave you after you wrote the book.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about ultimately what turned into a meeting in your office, and you went through piece by piece, literally, in the book, and he gave you some feedback and answers to what you had written.
That was an extraordinary day. I was not expecting any response from him, or maybe I thought there might be a sentence or two comment on the book. As he started giving me response to each story, it was as if we were having the conversation that I'd wanted to have for the past 20 years. But then also the book would not have been complete without his perspective. And that's what I think is the key that makes the book important to read, because you can really see the contrast between our perspectives. And that's the real beauty of the book, I think. With practice and prayer, instead of constantly worrying about Daniel's growth, I simply enjoy being with my son while we go to a movie or walk the dogs. I look for chances to ask him for advice. Instead of pleading for him to join me at my hurried pace, I try to enter his world on his terms. I put aside my agenda so that we can wander around the local farmer's market. Passively, I follow his lead and stop only when he stops. Now I see more than the fresh flowers and vegetables within my rehearsed focus. Daniel opens my eyes to the funky homemade chocolate lollipops. I still grieve for the hugs I miss and the conversations I crave. My sadness for my loss continues to sting, but I turn my focus to appreciating the treasure of his character, even if it is rarely shared. I take a deep breath so I can accept the uncomfortably long periods of silence. Grateful for any opportunity to be together, I am willing to sit with him in the dark in his apartment instead of asking him to turn on the lights. Oddly enough, my eyes are adjusting. I now see more clearly how to allow Daniel to live his own life while I go about living mine.
Nilla Childs. She was reading from Piece by Piece from her book Puzzled, 100 Pieces of Autism. Join Nilla at the Forsyth County Public Library, Walkertown Branch, on January 22nd at 7 p.m. to discuss her book. You can find links to Nilla's book, her website, and blog at wfdd.org/triadarts.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. All right, Triad Arts Weekend. Dance, music, theater, art, and now, thanks to Bethany, literature. She'll be back next month. And today, only on Triad Arts Weekend, you can add the art of viola to that mix. Yes, that's right, viola. You may not be aware of what every music conservatory kid soon finds out, and that is that the viola and those who play it have been maligned for centuries. And it's true that in the orchestra, viola has always been the middle child, larger, heavier, and harder to play than its smaller sister, the violin, and unable to achieve the lowest lows of its big brother, the cello. But, as we're about to find out, in the hands of a great performer, the viola is a wonderful, often vocal-sounding string instrument in its own right, with lots of great music to play. University of North Carolina School of the Arts professor of viola, Sheila Brown, is one such performer, and you can hear for yourself during her upcoming recital with Czech pianist David Kalhaus and harpist Jackie Bartlett. The performance is Tuesday night, January 15th at 7:30 in beautiful Watson Hall on the UNCSA campus. On the wide-ranging program titled The Viola in My Life, is the Morton Feldman piece by the same name, music by Turkish composer Hasan Ukarsu, Haydn Divertimenti, originally for cello, Paul Hindemith's 1939 Sonata, and Benjamin Britten's Lacrimae, just in time for what would have been Britten's 100th birthday. Sheila joined me live in Studio A to shatter the many myths surrounding her instrument and repertoire. Well, Sheila, I'm so glad to finally, after lo these many years, get to share with our listening audience the beauty, the glory of the viola, and especially in the hands of a great player like yourself. Welcome.
Thank you, David. I'm thrilled to be here to talk about the viola, my favorite subject.
That's and pigs.
Pigs are another favorite subject of mine.
Okay. Well, yes. We may get to that later, but first, it's all viola all the time. And I think a lot of non-musicians may not know, and I think to set the backdrop here, let's be honest, the viola, over the years, has been a much maligned instrument.
And still is.
And it still is. I mean, the common misconceptions, and maybe just rattle off a couple, and where do they come from?
Well, you know, the middle child often gets squeezed in the middle, which is what we have here. We have the violin on one side, which is the brilliant pyrotechnics, and the cello, which is supposed to be, you know, the epitome of the human voice, which I guess could work. But I think the viola actually could also be considered very human because it's not the ideal dimensions like the violin is. So it's much harder to play than the violin because it's big.
It's bigger.
And yeah.
Yeah. The fingers have to stretch farther.
Right. And it's heavy. You have to hold that thing up for long periods of time. And, you know, so there are a lot of technical things that are actually harder on the viola than on the violin.
Okay. Got to do it. Let's knock down the myths. First off, viola joke number one. How is lightning like a viola's fingers? Neither one strikes in the same place twice. Completely wrong. Completely wrong. We can demonstrate that, can't we?
The lightning strikes?
Could you just play this? Yeah, I'm thinking if you could just play the same note twice, we can prove this. We can disprove this.
We can dispel this myth right off the bat.
You see that? Her fingers went off the fretboard and right back in the exact same spot. The pitch was perfect. By the way, do you have perfect pitch?
I do.
Yeah, I had a feeling. Perfect pitch, by the way, is just someone you could say, okay, sing me a C sharp. I'm not going to ask her to sing. She's got a cold today, but... That just makes me sick. So myth number two, and we're not going to do this all day. I want to get into the meat and potatoes, but I've got to do this because how often do I get a chance to speak with one of the nation's great violists here? How can you tell when a violist is playing out of tune?
See, I don't know the answers to any of these jokes.
Of course, so. You wouldn't deign to even. The answer is the bow is moving.
Wow.
Isn't that cruel? And these are some of the nicer viola jokes out there, but I want to disprove this. We've already disproven it in a sense, but how about you can just play any note, Sheila, and I guarantee you it's going to be perfectly in tune. Listen, folks. That is in tune. What was that?
That was an
E-flat. Okay, I have no idea what... no, nothing to do with perfect pitch. Okay, good. So your first brush with viola that really hit it, I've got to pick up this instrument and run with it. What, do you remember?
Absolutely. I was in the public school system in fourth grade, and at that time in the public school system on the main line outside of Philadelphia,
okay,
where I grew up, you could pick an orchestral instrument to study. You know, there were a lot of girls picking up the violin, and the cello was pretty popular too, and I guess I always was a little bit off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, the viola, that's a gorgeous name. I think I'd really like that. And I did. I took to it. Right away. I think my voice is actually in the tessitura of the viola in the same range. When I wake up in the morning, I can actually hit the low C on the viola. But, you know, the rest of the day, I get everything from D up, up to the third octave or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has a resonating chord with my personality. It can be, you know, very exciting as well as mellow. It has this chocolatey resonance, which is just gorgeous. It's a very earthy instrument often.
Yeah.
So it really runs the gamut in a way that a lot of people don't realize.
Beginning with the title of the program, The Viola in My Life, after Morton Feldman's piece, what grabs you about Feldman?
Well, his soundscape is completely unique from anything else that violists play. Things move at a glacially slow pace in his music, which I just love. It's a whole different mindset, and I think it's very meditative to play music like this.
Yeah.
Also, for the age that we live in, which is all about hype and go, 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 and Starbucks and all of this, this slows us down and makes us hyper aware, in a good way, of the little noises that we don't hear all the time. So it really expands your range of what you hear. You know, it also tests the limits of what we think music should be.
What I love about the third movement is it seems like the perfect pairing of the attack of the piano and the sustain of the viola, like it's one instrument. Is it tough to time it from a performer's perspective? What's it like being in that moment, and what are the challenges in this movement?
Well, that's right, because, you know, you have to kind of fill in where the piano left off, and as the piano is resonating, you do have to enter that world. Violists actually are very good. My teacher, Karen Tuttle, used to talk about crawling in another person's skin to play an inner voice in a string quartet, which is what we often do. So this is similar in the sense that you have to kind of morph out of the piano sound and come in and out depending on how important your line is. And of course, the viola is the solo line. So we have to be able to balance that.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I'm talking today with violist Sheila Brown. Elif Datum Bey Datum for viola and harp. And this is a version by Hasan Ukarsu.
Yes.
It's a Turkish folk song, and it was on YouTube. It was being played by various performers on a Turkish guitar-like instrument, which I believe is the baglama.
Yes, and also it's sung as well.
Okay.
There are also words to it.
Okay. It's a neat tune. I want to find out more about the tune and the viola arrangement. But first, you've got a big Turkey trip coming up tomorrow.
I do. I'm actually going to get to meet Hasan for the first time in Turkey. I'm going with the Keenan Institute, with David Nelson, who's our provost at UNCSA, where I am the professor of viola. And we're going to have these roundtable discussions as part of this Art Islam project that the Keenan Institute at School of the Arts is starting.
I want to hear just a little bit about Art Islam because it's a fascinating program.
Well, the Art Islamic program, we're kind of in the beginning stages where people from, you know, the East, it's sort of East meets West, are going to go to Istanbul, which of course is sort of the gateway to the East and to the West, depending on which side you're on. So we have artists and musicians and dancers, choreographers, film people all coming together, and academics as well from Duke and UNC Chapel Hill, all coming together and having these roundtable discussions to see what we can do to bring these different sides together. This is nice to get the dialogue going, to have these sorts of conferences and to meet people from, you know, the Middle East and from the West, too.
And in the spirit of this show, it's the viola, bringing people together and changing the world.
And, you know, that is often the role of violists because we are the middle child and we do often bridge the gap.
That's it.
So it makes sense. And, you know, violists are supposed to be a little more mild-mannered. Maybe not with me always, but, you know, we are supposed to be kind of more on the mellow side and you know, keeping the peace.
Well, first off, I love the program for the mix of styles because we're going from Feldman to Turkish folk music for viola,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
now to another guy who knew how to keep the peace, Franz Josef Haydn, who
Haydn.
Papa Haydn. No, the way when he arrived there with the Esterházy Orchestra, he wrote little solos in for all the members of the orchestra to make them feel good and kind of
good for him.
Kind of lay the groundwork. This divertimento originally for cello.
That's right.
First off, is that a normal transcription going from cello to viola? Whatever normal is that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a fair amount of material that's been transcribed. I also just transcribed the Prokofiev cello sonata, which is going to come out on CD by the end of this next year. You know, it depends on what type of a violist you are. I think I tend to be more attracted to the, say, cellistic side of the viola. So that's that great low C string. So that happens a lot that we take cello music. Hindemith is underrepresented in the concert hall today. Some of his music is thorny, you know, depending on what phase he was in. So it takes a bit longer. It takes more than one hearing to get into the spirit. And of course, that is the beauty of being a violist, is that we have seven sonatas of Hindemith and three concerti. He championed the viola as a solo instrument. He was touring all around America and Europe playing these viola solos.
As a violist playing a piece written by Hindemith, whose, I guess, his forte instrument was viola, do you get a sense of, oh, this guy knew his stuff, or was it still just, is it awkward, and how does it lie compared to other works?
You know, it's very challenging technically, but in a way that's extremely satisfying because it does lie well on the viola. You really have a sense that this man understood what the viola was capable of. And I really don't think anyone before or after Hindemith quite understood viola the way he did. He had these gorgeous melodies, you know, these breathtakingly beautiful slow movements that actually some of them sound a little bit like Feldman. You know, they can be very kind of stark, like a cloudy day that moves very slowly. Everything is sort of underwater a bit. Or he has these really hard licks that go on for pages on end and you're sometimes not sure it's worth it. Sometimes his stuff can sound sort of etude-y. But he has brilliant writing as well that's very difficult. A lot of chords that can be very difficult to get in tune and so on. But he's second to none in terms of showing what the viola is capable of in terms of, you know, really hard technical things as well as gorgeous beauty and anything in between, really. A lot of different characters in his music.
Well, you mentioned
dark earlier, and, dark and foreboding comes to mind. The Britten piece, at least large sections of this thing, kind of lush, dark realm. And then at the very end, it's like a bat out of hell, right? And then you got to end.
Well, it's funny because this is a theme in Variations, but it's backwards. So you have the most abstract variations in the opening of the piece, and then it clarifies as you get closer and closer to the end. It turns into this beautiful John Dowland song. Flow My Tears, which is lacrimae, is the from the Latin, of course, meaning tears, which is the title of this work. And so it just sort of soars at the end, you know, with this simple, gorgeous melody. But it starts out, that's right, kind of from the bowels and works its way up to heaven type thing.
I feel like I would be remiss in not asking for a slow scale, just from the bottom of the range to the top.
So let's see. For something like this, we're probably going up to an F. So.
Wow.
So it's pretty high.
Yeah, that gets up there.
It's getting up near my nose.
Violist and University of North Carolina School of the Arts Professor Sheila Brown. The Viola in My Life with Sheila, pianist David Kallhaus, and harpist Jackie Bartlett is Tuesday night, January 15th at 7:30 in beautiful Watson Hall on the UNCSA campus. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. Eddie Garcia produces Triad Arts Weekend. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and we'd love to hear from you. Send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes at wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.
Sir.